So, what's trending? Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio.
Good evening. Stacy Trusenko's here filling in for Timory while she still enjoys her new baby, her new bundle of joy at home. I hear she's got some pictures up on Instagram if you would like to go take a look, because that's what we need right now. We need pictures of beautiful babies. That's all I'm thinking about this week is babies and happiness. No stress at all. This is absolutely not a stressful week. Welcome to the show tonight. I'm very happy to talk to you again. And got a couple of things to talk about. I noticed today off the bat that our friend Richard Dawkins, I don't know, I think it's been a long time since anybody's really talked about him very much. I remember when I first got to the faith and science scene as a new Catholic and always a chemist, I was very intrigued by the things that he would say. And today on Twitter, he posted, I don't know whether he knew this or not, he posted a quote from G.K. Chesterton. So it was interesting. I'll read that to you in just a minute, and I have a few more things to say about it. I think he got the quote from Chesterton's Orthodoxy, and I have a couple of quotes in that book that I like as well, and that I would love, if God ever gave me the chance, I would love to talk to Richard Dawkins about it. I've talked to a couple of outspoken atheists in my time, and I think it went well. So we'll talk more about that and also how to talk to atheists, how to talk confidently about your faith when someone criticizes you for your faith. There was an article in Christianity Today with some advice on how to talk to people about your faith, how to handle criticism. That was on FaithWire, I'm sorry, how to handle criticism of your faith. And I think we have, as Catholics, some things to add to that, because whenever I was learning, and I'm sure you've been there too, learning and thinking about how to talk to other people about your faith and what do you do when people criticize you. I remember the feeling, I thought being Catholic was so great. I couldn't wait to tell everybody. And then I was shocked, literally shocked, when people are like, "Well, that's so dumb. You believe in a God you have no evidence for." And I had to learn, like you did too, how to answer those people. So I was really delighted that the church, in its treasure trove of magisterial documents and writings of the church fathers, there's so much there to dig into that really goes, in my opinion, a lot deeper than you find from other Christians. You know, there are brothers and sisters, but Catholicism is the best kind of Christianity, if you want to say it that way. That's how I like to say it. I live here in the Bible Belt in the Protestant land down in Texas, so we have a lot of people around here who love Jesus, and it's always interesting to talk to them and find out what our differences are and what our similarities are and see how we might lead them to the fullness of the truth. In the last segment, I'm going to talk about something that is a little more controversial for us as we try to navigate these difficult times of COVID-19. There was an article in the New York Times this week that really kind of stirred the pot. Like, we didn't need more things to be stirring the pot over, but it was about children's screen time and how that has soared during the pandemic, the COVID effect, they call it. And it's alarming parents and researchers. And it was kind of a shocking article, but not a surprising article. And it just seems like it's good to dive into this topic, because it's easy to say on one hand, oh yes, too much screen time, that's not a good thing. We should monitor that. We should check it on. I mean, we should let our phones check our digital wellness and see how well we're not staying on our screens too long, and if we're wearing our blue filter glasses, and then if parents always asking the question, how do they monitor what their kids are doing online and not just how much time their kids spend online? I may be an expert in faith and science and chemistry, but let me tell you something. I am really an expert in managing children's screen time because my kids are brilliant. They can work around everything I do to try to thwart their access to things. And I've solved just about every problem there is to be solved. And so I'm going to share that hard-earned brilliance that my brilliant kids have imparted to me as we've basically been at war over screen time. And I mean, it starts with me. It goes all the way back to the invention of the iPod, that little tiny device that allowed my now grown daughter to store 20 hours worth of music on it. And I had to sit there for 20 hours so I could know what she's listening to. And at some point I decided that putting the boot of my heel to it was an easier way to monitor. So that was my first solution. And I've sort of matured since those days. I'm not above putting a heel of a boot to a device anymore. And I think that's really my secret. So they know I will do it because I have done it. But I'd like to dive into this topic because I do think it's something that we need to discuss realistically, and we need to figure out what it is we're doing on the internet. I'm not a person who just freaks out about screen time. I don't think the internet is a bad thing. I don't think social media is a bad thing. I think it just shoves us all up in each other's face like never before. And we have to be really keen about how we practice virtue, given that heightened in-your-faceness that we live in with the whole world. So more than ever, we have to learn how to use prudence, practice prudence, justice, fortitude, and temperance when we're working on the screens. But anyway, I have a lot to say about that, and I don't hear it discussed a lot. I hear a lot of sensational things, like in the New York Times, being said, but I get the feeling that a lot of people who say my kid only has 2 hours of screen time a day, or I only have 4 hours of screen time a day, I get the feeling those people are not being totally honest. Because if you can do that, more power to you. I would not be able to function without my phone. I don't mind saying it's a tool. So anyway, back to Richard Dawkins. We will get to that feat of science called screen time later in the show. I want to go back to this quote by Richard Dawkins. This is what he said. And no, I will not be saying it in a British accent. I wish I could, but if I tried, it would just be bad for everybody. And so I'm not going to even try that. So just try to listen to my Texas accent and pretend like it's really a British accent and it's me talking like Richard Dawkins. Okay. He posted this on Twitter, quoting G.K. Chesterton, "We should always endeavor to wonder at the permanent thing, not at the mere exception. We should be startled by the sun and not by the eclipse. We should wonder less at the earthquake and wonder more at the earth." And the end. And that is not something you would expect him to have posted. And there was a comment below it that really made me laugh. To Richard Dawkins, "Have you read any GKC essays or books in their entirety? The religious world is now having kittens after you posted this." So I don't actually know what that means to have kittens, but I think it means we're kind of going nuts about it. We're sort of like, oh my gosh, Richard Dawkins posted G.K. Chesterton. I wonder if he's going to become Christian now. Probably not. But, you know, he's getting older, so maybe he'll have a change of heart. But yeah, it does sound like he just probably thought this quote was good, and he decided to just post it. Now, here's what I thought when I read that. Like, first of all, as a chemist and a Catholic, I've always kind of just thought that when we get to ordinary time, you know, like we've been in for a couple of weeks now, I'm always like, ordinary time? What's so ordinary about ordinary time? if you're talking about chemistry, you know, I know we're talking about the liturgy, but for me, that's like all the same thing. What's so ordinary about ordinary time? Because when you think about it, if you just stand outside, it can move you to tears. It has moved me to tears before, I won't lie. If you stand outside and you just look around you for, take about 10 minutes and just think about it. Maybe go read some chemistry textbook before you do that. There's an orchestration of atoms forming molecules, doing things thermodynamically, energetically, and it is all so balanced. Like, you could not write down on a million sheets of paper all the chemical equations that have to happen just for your heart to beat one time, or for you to breathe in that air. Because when you breathe in air, this kind of grosses my kids out, but when you breathe in air molecules, literally, God alone knows, only God knows where in the universe those air molecules have been that you just sucked in through your nose, and they're going to go run around in your body and do some stuff before they come out somewhere, you know, whether you breathe them back out eventually or whatever, that they go on be part of your metabolism. You have no way of knowing where those air molecules that make up the air, all the different molecules, the oxygen and nitrogen and all the other stuff, depending on where you live, you don't know where it's come from because gas molecules are always moving around so fast. It's amazing what it takes for us to see a sunrise. It's amazing what it takes in the universe just for us to exist. So when Richard Dawkins says, and here we are in ordinary time, and I'm always like, what's so ordinary about ordinary time? We should endeavor to wonder at the permanent thing, not the mere exception. I'm like, yes, yes, Mr. Dawkins, Dr. Dawkins. We should be startled by the sun and not by the eclipse. Amen. We should wonder less at the earthquake and wonder more at the earth. And this, you know, I don't know how I don't have no idea what was going on in his mind when he wrote this or quoted this from G.K. Chesterton. But I've always sort of in my mind imagined if someone ever asked me to debate Richard Dawkins. So like in my mind, I picture myself going to debate him. And I'll talk about this more in the second segment. I've pictured going to debate him. And so I have 7 kids. Okay, just prefacing what I'm about to say. I would totally come to the stage probably with a sheet a plate of cookies or something. I'd be like, hi, Richard. It's so good to talk to you about this faith, you know, about Christianity. Let's just talk. Like, I don't really want to argue because, like, true to Dale Carnegie and his book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, I don't really want to argue with you. I just want to understand more about how you think. Like, you explain to me how you get there. I'm a very big believer in finding the common ground. And then I'm very much in support of pushing them over helping them get over that last edge. I'll push them off a cliff, but help them get to that last point where they voluntarily take the leap of faith. And I, you know, I'm not saying, oh, just give me some chocolate chip cookies in 30 minutes and I'll make sure Richard Dawkins becomes Christian. I'm not saying that, but I would be very interested to hear what he has to say. I've had, one of the best discussions I ever had was with the professor who won the Templeton Prize a few years ago, and he's atheist. Forget his name. He's atheist, and he had just won this $1 million Templeton Prize, and I did an interview with him in a British radio station, actually, And it went just like that, you know. It was just a conversation. How do you view the world? Well, here's how I view the world. And he explained how he viewed the world, and he just said, I don't have a way to I don't believe anything I don't have evidence for. And I said, well, here's my worldview, and I explained how the order makes sense to me because God is rational. And it was a good conversation. And I don't know. I think that I gave him some things to think about. On that note, though, I want you to hear something else that Richard Dawkins also said along those lines about the wonder and about Christianity and what he really thinks, though. Just one more hard hit. Here's a quote from Richard Dawkins about in 2015.
You said in a speech famously that I think a case can be made that faith is one of the world's great evils, comparable to the smallpox virus, but harder to eradicate.
I do think that, yes. Because what I'm talking about there is faith, where faith means belief in something without evidence. Because if you believe something without evidence, then that justifies anything. You're no longer vulnerable to somebody coming back at you and saying, hang on a minute, let me argue the case. If you believe it without evidence, which is what faith is, then you don't argue the case. You say, no, I'm not arguing that case. This is my faith. It's mine. It's private. I don't dissent from it. I don't retreat from it. You're just going to have to accept it. Now, that is evil.
So there you go. Tell us how you really feel, Richard. So this is him, first of all, comparing it to a virus. No pun intended. But comparing it to a virus. But he has said that on many occasions. As far as I know, he still thinks this way. But to the atheists of the world, who a lot of them follow him, I just want to say to them, like, how do you make sense of your own worldview? How do you make sense of your own worldview? And if you would like to jump into this conversation, go ahead and give us a call. The number, let me just call it out, 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Feel free to jump in on this conversation, what you would say to Richard Dawkins if you had a chance. I mean, you could go tweet back to him, I guess, but I don't know if he'll read it or not. But I would really love to have a long, drawn-out conversation, cookies, coffee, whatever, where I could press him on these things that he says. So if I don't get upset. I don't get angry. Like, he can say that if he wants to, but it's not really how it works, Richard. It's not like that. I don't have belief without evidence. Well, I do have belief without evidence, but it's reasonable. Okay? And you'll have to come back in the second segment. We're coming up on a break in a little bit. I'm going to go into that thing that we say as Catholics, why belief is more certain than knowledge. That's something that I used to be like, what? What do you mean? Well, I figured it out, and I want to share it with you because we have that great treasure trove of the Catholic Church. I'm Stacey Trusankos. We will be back in a few minutes and talk about belief and knowledge and Richard Dawkins.
Relevant Radio is supported by CatholicSingles.com and the Catholic Singles app, the Catholic dating community for single men and women to meet other single Catholics through interactive polls and personalized matches. CatholicSingles.com, genuinely Catholic.
So, what's trending? Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Welcome back to the show. This is Stacey Trusankos in for Timory. We were talking before the break about Richard Dawkins and his G.K. Chesterton tweet today and how delightful that was. And we have a couple of callers who would like to join in on the conversation about what we would say to Richard Dawkins if we had the chance to sit down and talk with him. We have Donna on the phone. Donna, go ahead.
Hi there. I have wanted to ask this to people that believe in evolution my whole life, and I don't know any of these people, so maybe somebody will answer. But anyway, I just want to know, you know, everything in the world that's alive basically is male and female. So they say they evolved, but they had to evolve as either male or female until the other one got evolved. I don't see how that could ever be. I think that totally is contrary to everything that they say, because there's no way to evolve. Like, if we were all amoebas, okay, we could do that. But when you're evolving male and female for everything in the world, I don't see how that's even possible.
Yes, and I can tell you about what he would say to that, Donna. Because evolution probably is a whole other show, but I do appreciate you bringing it up because that is one thing he talks about the most. He would say that evolution is the change in, it's change. It's just change in the physical world over time. And that it took a long time for the first cell to evolve, if there was a cell, who knows, for life to evolve. And then as the diversity of life came to be over time, there were lots of things in the environment, natural selection, and in the changing of the genetic code once there was one. That took a long time too. That those things started to evolve, and that different genders would have evolved as a way to reproduce. I mean, that's the nutshell of it. He would give you a materialistic explanation for it from a biology textbook. He would give you an explanation like that. As a Catholic, we can follow the change in matter. There's no problem with that as long as we're viewing everything as the handiwork of God. And as long as when it gets to human beings, we don't deny the existence of the soul. We just don't stop at the physical or material world. We also acknowledge the supernatural, the spiritual realm, both. That's probably what he would say to you, but he would... Yeah, it's evolution is a hard thing to understand. But it's okay, just to give you assurance, it's okay to see the world as changing and evolving as they're being changed, because there's no such thing as absolute no motion, zero motion. So things are always moving, things are always changing, and it is very complicated to go through how life might have first arisen from inorganic matter. You know, scientists just have ideas and theories. Nobody was there, so we don't know firsthand. I hope that gives you some kind of answer there, Donna. And I think that's about what he would say.
It's just that it doesn't make sense. There's no sense to it at all. And I don't understand how it could even happen. And to me, that's why God said, I'm going to make them male and female, mm-hmm. everything. And I think that's his, you know, way of saying you're silly.
Yeah.
It can't happen.
There has to be purpose.
You know, you can't do it.
Yep. No, and God knows why he did it, and we don't. And I agree with you that it doesn't make sense if you take God out of the equation. Evolution or anything else doesn't make any sense. Let's go to the next caller. We have a caller from San Francisco, Skanda. Go ahead.
Right. Hi. So I had this thought about having a worldview in the first place. I think my point was not everyone really needs to have a worldview. I mean, let's face it, not everyone is on the path to change the world. But I think having a worldview really misses the more subtle, more fundamental point, which is not to look at world from a source and a destination, but an experience itself. I mean, every day when I get up, or every day when most people, in fact, 99% of the world population gets up, they're not really interested in changing the world. They're not really interested in saying how I'm going to do something that's going to really affect the world. All they really want to do is get up, experience that specific day, and look forward to another day. So if I was asking a question to Richard Dawkins about worldview, I would have really asked him, what is the importance of having a worldview in the first place? I mean,
there
why have a worldview? How does your life changes if you have a worldview and if you don't have a worldview?
Yes, and what would you say, that's Skanda? Why do you think it's important to have a worldview?
Well, I don't. I mean, frankly, I'm close to about 40 years now, and in the 40 years that I've lived on this earth, not once I have gotten up early in the morning or sometimes during the day or, you know, before I sleep and ever thought about what my worldview is. And I think I've turned out just fine. So I really don't care what the worldview is.
Okay. Thank you. You probably will think about it tomorrow morning, though, right? Because now that we're having this discussion, I understand what you're saying. I totally agree. And I would respond to that to Richard Dawkins, and I'll respond to it to you. You're right. All you really have to do, and this happened, I mean, what you just said is like diagnostic of the situation in the world today with believers and non-believers. Nobody makes you get up in the morning and say, what's my worldview? Like you're so right. You don't have to do that. You can put on a lab coat and go into the lab and do research, and you never have to ask the question, where did this all come from? You never have to say, how am I looking at the world? What are my basic assumptions? What do I believe? What do I think? When I look through my eyeballs, and by the way, there's a lot of chemistry there. Okay, I'm not going to talk about chemistry. When I look through my eyeballs at things and light's coming in and my brain's processing what I see, what is this all about? What am I doing looking at this world? And that is something, you know, it's when we're babies, we wake up, we cry, we're hungry, we want our diaper changed, we don't have to think about anything. But when we get older and we exercise our rational soul, our intellect, and our free will, I think it's very satisfying to get up and say, what is my worldview? How am I looking at the world? And that was a lot of what changed my heart and mind to become Catholic, having been a chemist as long as I can remember. And I mean, I did. I loved it. I loved science when I was a little girl. And I remember thinking that, like, what am I looking at? There's a lot of things in my studies of Catholic teaching that just floored me. I remember reading the opening lines of Frank Sheed's book, Theology and Sanity, and I don't have it in front of me, so I'm going from memory. But Frank Sheed uses words like they cost $100 each. Like, he does not waste words. And in the opening book, he says, what does a Catholic see? The Catholic sees what's there. It's like we are trying to find the truth. We are trying to look with clear vision, mentally, spiritually, and with our own eyes. We're trying to see what's really there. And so that leads you to a set of questions. And he argues in that book, we have to exercise our intellect, that sanctity is about the will, but sanity, theology and sanity, is about seeing what's there. And so when you start out like that, as a scientist or as anybody else, I came to this line, you have to see the world as the handiwork of God. You have to see all creation as the handiwork of God. And you get right back to that quote from Chesterton that Dawkins tweeted, we should always endeavor to wonder at the permanent thing, not the mere exception. We should be startled by the sun and not by the eclipse. We should wonder less at the earthquake and wonder more at the earth and our place in the world. That was me adding that in. But it is a very satisfying question to say, what is my worldview? And I promise you, you can go as far as you can humanly go. God will tell you the rest when you've reasoned as far as you can. That's what being Catholic is all about. Jesus Christ revealed truths to us that we wouldn't have reasoned on our own. And then we reasoned forth, and that's called theology. And we worship, that's called religion, to try to pay God back for our existence, knowing we can try like everything, but, and that's why we have liturgy wars, we can try like everything, but we'll never fully repay God for our existence. But it's so amazing just to think what that means, to be held in existence each moment. So anyway, Richard Dawkins, if you're listening, I bake really good chocolate chip cookies, and I got a family here who would love to talk to you sometime and press you on some of these questions. And it won't upset me at all if you say Christianity is like a virus. I'll let you finish your sentence, because that's a rule in our house. Let people finish their sentences. And then I'll push you to explain your worldview, man. Okay, so moving on from that, and thank you for the calls. If you want to call in with another comment, 888-914-9149. We're talking about big and important stuff here. Another article, I love these. You see these a lot. This was on FaithWire, how to handle criticism of your faith. Y'all just saw how we would handle it. You just got to be confident. Something I wrote a lot about in my book, Particles of Faith, and I noticed it resonated with a lot of people because they told me it did, and I didn't really expect that, but it was to be confident in your faith. And that's what this article is saying. You know, I was talking about it through the lens of chemistry because I was making the point, don't ever use science to shore up your faith. You're supposed to hold your faith in confidence. Certain belief is certain. And you don't, if you start going around, oh, hey, the Big Bang proves God, then you make it sound like you don't have certain belief, that you are looking for science to shore up your faith. And that's backwards. So, but this article is not just talking about faith and science. This article is talking about everything. When you are being criticized for your faith, if you are, don't get defensive, the author says. Don't get defensive, and I totally, totally agree. I could not agree with that more. Anytime you get defensive, what you're showing is that you're not so confident in your belief. You've got to get defensive. And you know, I have four teenagers right now, and I see them do this a lot, and I just try to remember that's part of growing up. Sometimes a person gets defensive because you're afraid you're going to be criticized more, and you just want to talk over the other person so you don't have to endure any more criticism. But you got to let people, so they'll grow past that. And I've learned just to let them be defensive until they get done, and then we keep talking. But if you get defensive, you shut down the conversation. Just let them finish with their criticism and get it all out. Put up your shield. Don't let it affect you. But then stay calm. You've got to stay calm, and you've got to not take it personally. If it gets abusive, walk away, definitely. But if it's just criticism, let them finish and then say, okay, you know, don't come off sharp or angry or hurt or overwhelmed. You can hash that out later when nobody's looking. The other advice in this article is to find common ground. And we were just talking about that as well. Find common ground. And the author here is talking about even how the early Christians did and how the saints did. I'm going to read this scripture. There's a speech quoting the Greek poet Aratus. God did this so they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far away from any of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. We've all heard that before. As some of your own poets have said, that's the common ground. We are his offspring. So they, in the early days, the Hellenistic Greeks and the Stoic and the Epicurean philosophers, if you read the early church fathers, you'll see a lot of this. They were engaging with the people of Athens and engaging with the people of their time. Even when St. Paul was saying that he's walked around, this is in Acts 17:22, and he saw their objects of worship, and he noticed that they had an altar with an inscription to an unknown God. And he says, so you are ignorant of the very thing you worship, and this is what I'm going to proclaim to you. I don't recommend really saying it just like that. Maybe you should. I don't know. You'll have to be the judge of that depending on who you're talking to. But you want to find that common ground. You're worshiping something. Richard Dawkins is awed by something. And so push them, tell them that you are awed by something too, and invite them into a deeper discussion about what that something is. And then keep the main thing the main thing. It's the very last part of this article. Keep the main thing the main thing. This will be linked on the webpage. But the main thing they're talking about here is Jesus Christ. So don't get derailed by all kinds of other things. You know, you can have the derail for a minute, but get back on track. We're talking about Jesus Christ. And I want to add a little bit more to that. So I said before the break, we were going to talk about belief is more certain than knowledge. If I can cover this very quickly, because we're coming up on another break, but I want to give you the Stacy Trisenko's version of what this means, but it's also grounded in St. Thomas Aquinas and in Joseph Pieper, the German philosopher who was a Thomist. And I really appreciated how he explained it, because he was writing about, you know, he's got the book, The Four Cardinal Virtues, and he's got the other book, Faith, Hope, and Love, the three theological virtues. And he was writing about faith and following St. Thomas Aquinas, where he also writes about faith in the Summa. And he was saying that belief is more certain than knowledge. And what he means by that, so let's define our terms. Belief is defined in Hebrews 1:11. It is the evidence. Remember Richard Dawkins used that word, evidence? It is the evidence of things, what? Unseen. the evidence of things unseen. So we're not looking for evidence when we're talking about faith. We're not looking at belief without evidence. Yes, that's what it is. And look, guys, you got to be comfortable saying that. You got to say, yeah, it is faith, according to Hebrews 11:1, is the realization of what is hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. So it's like this. Okay, walking you through a story, I sort of tell this my own way, different from Joseph Pieper, but kind of along his lines. He didn't have Facebook, but we do. Say you see a story on Facebook about a parrot who saves a toddler. There was a story. This is actually a story on Facebook. The story says a child was gasping for air while eating food in a high chair. The parrot, squawked the words, "Mama, baby," in a way that caused the actual mother to run into the room just in time to see and help her child. So like the parrot saw the child choking and called the mother, "Mama, baby." Now, when I read this article, or if you read this article, I could ask you, do you believe that? Can you believe that? And you might say, yes. And you would mean that you find the claim realistic and the person who wrote the article credible. If you say no, you would mean the author is mistaken or the author is dishonest, that the author is, you know, you can't believe that. You might declare the whole story make-believe. Okay, so we know what those words mean. Or you might say you don't believe the story because you know it to be true. Maybe you were there visiting with that mother when the whole thing went down and you would have some explaining to do for not speaking up to help the child in distress instead of the parrot. But let's say you were there, you would know the story to be true if you saw it with your own eyes. That's what knowledge is. That's what we do in science. We don't make believe in science. We see things with our own observational skills. So belief is different from knowledge. To believe means you're willing to accept something as objectively true based on the testimony of someone else. Okay? Belief and knowledge are two forms of assent to the truth of something. Belief lacks familiarity, the very thing required for knowledge. So see, that's the difference in the two. Now, let's talk about belief being reasonable. In terms of certitude, belief has to be superior. Why? Belief has to be superior because if you say, I believe in that person, let's say it's the testimony of something by someone credible. Then you say, I believe that person. If you believe in that person, it means you believe everything that person says is true. So we're getting to Christianity now, okay? Think about cafeteria Catholics. If you say something like, I don't know the Pythagorean theorem today, you might know it tomorrow because you can go learn it, right? That's what kids do in school. But if you say, I don't believe you today, but I might believe you tomorrow, or I don't believe something today, but I might believe it tomorrow, then you, my friend, are contradicting yourself because you never believed it at all. Do you see what I'm saying? If you truly believe something, you are certain about it. You don't change from one day to the next. Ding, ding, ding. Catholics, talking to you. So belief is intellectually responsible so this is where we get childlike faith. Children believe in their parents when they're little, not when they're teenagers, but when they're little, your little 2-year-old, you're like, oh, don't eat that. It'll hurt you. They mostly won't. Okay. As they start getting older, they'll like, oh, if you tell me not to, I'm going to. But a little bitty child has complete faith in her parents. But as you get older, you start to question things. And there's two narrow ways we can have responsible, mature belief. If someone exists who is incomparably superior to a mature person, more superior than a parent even is to a child, that someone with a capital S, and if that someone speaks to us, and that someone, of course, is Christ. So when we say, I believe in Christ, that has to be more certain than knowledge. And it's reasonable and it's responsible. But look, if you believe in Christ, then you better believe the Eucharist is really his true presence because he said it is. And that's what our whole faith is based on. Okay, so there is the lesson about belief and knowledge. I have a lot written about that. I can share it. We're getting ready to go to a break. And when we come back from the break, we're going to switch gears a little bit and talk about responsible, mature internet use. I'm Stacey Trusenko. See you in a little bit.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Welcome back to the show. This is Stacey Trusenkos filling in for Timory while she is out on maternity leave with her beautiful baby girl. We were talking before the break about belief and knowledge, and we have a caller, Craig. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi. Well, I believe that we all should be submissive to our actions of honesty and purity, and just being understood that we're being watched when we're being tested of temptation, and that when we do that, miracles come beautifully. And I'm a proof of it.
Oh, that's great. That is a wonderful testimony, Craig. I know what you're talking about. You said we're being watched as we're being tested, and that's so true. Christ is always right there. I was just telling someone today who was trying to make a very hard decision, and I told her pretty much the same thing that you just said. You got to pray. Tell God, I'm trying to do what you want me to do. I just don't know what that is. I mean, I've gotten angry before. God, I signed up. I'm all in. I believe in you. I believe in you, Christ. But could you just like appear to me right now and tell me what I'm supposed to do in this really hard decision? Because I am trying like everything to do the right thing. And I just don't know. And I think that is the test sometimes. We only get enough clarity and light to see the next few steps in front of us. And we walk forward in faith, in blind obedience sometimes, like you said, Craig, and we just keep going. And I've lived long enough now that I get it. I can look back over many examples in my life. I tell my teenage daughters, you haven't seen this yet, but you will. Trust me. Believe in what I'm telling you here, that if you ask God for help and clarity in making a decision, it will come to you. It absolutely will. And you'll look back one day and you'll be like, oh, that's why I was going through that trial. Speaking of trials, we are all, I mean, this might sound like a lighter subject, but I know it's difficult. And I know it's difficult because the New York Times article stirred the pot quite a bit, talking about children's screen time and how it soared during the pandemic, alarming parents and researchers. It's a very good article. I recommend reading it. You know, I don't agree with a lot of things the New York Times says, but sometimes I just appreciate it as a pulse on the finger, on the wrist of society to try to, you know, gauge what's going on. But this father, it starts out, this day after New Year's, John Reichert of Boulder, Colorado, this is the article, had a heated argument with his 14-year-old son, James. The father says, I failed you as a father. He said it despairingly. And he said he didn't want to lose his son. His son got an argument with him about, and he said he was going to take away his phone. And the kid said, my phone is my whole life. And the father said, I'm not losing my son to this. And so they're despairing over this increased internet use among kids. And honestly, among adults too. And it is a thing. Okay. It is a thing, but it's not, it doesn't have to be that bad. So like I said before, I've got a lot of experience managing kids and screen time. And you know what? Some days they they really do want to just sit in front of the screen and play their computer games. And kids now, it's not like Atari when I was a kid and you know, just ding ding back and forth with the little ball, or I forget what all those games were, but I used to play them a lot too when I was a kid. But these days the games are, they're very engaging for their minds, and the kids are talking to other kids, and they're, you know, my son will sit with his Xbox, and he'll be playing it. No, it's a Nintendo Switch. I can't keep up. He'll sit with his Nintendo Switch, and he has his earbuds on, and he's jumping around, screaming and talking and having a good time playing with some other friend, and they're solving problems together and working things out. And you know what? I'm fine with that. I'm fine with it. He's sitting in the living room. We know what he's doing. He's not just vegetating. He's actually doing stuff. The kids have gotten into making little videos and making memes, and they've done a lot of things. So I try to just go with the flow. This is the time that we live in. My kids used more internet during the pandemic, but again, you know, part of the reason we live in Texas, that was a choice. We moved here because we wanted this environment for our kids. And so our kids were also able to get outside and do things. And once it's not a battle between you and the kid, you can kind of come to some terms. So this is a big subject. I'm not going to be able to cover everything, but I do want to just assure you that if you think your kids are on the screen too much, you can do simple things. Like, I don't recommend a lot of rules because kids are just going to break them and push them and push the envelope, but just set some expectations down. I want to have a conversation with you. You know, if you want your kid off the screen, ask them something that's an open-ended question and let them talk about it. Or maybe ask them about the game. Ask them about what they're playing. Ask them why they like it. Set up allowances. And when my kids do allowances and do work and get allowances, they spend it a lot of time on game stuff on the computer, but it keeps them going. It's collateral for them. So that's kind of the world we live in. All I can say now, just to give you the short version, it's okay. I also want to give you a few things I found that works. Okay. Cause we have spent thousands of dollars on apps and routers and whatnot, Kindle and parental controls. And they were not so great for a long time. The best one I found right now is Google Link on your kid's phone. Google Link. It's free because you can spend a lot of money on it. And it works because if somebody's like fighting and I say, if either one of you say one more word, you're losing the internet for an hour, they know I mean it because I will just go to my phone on the app and I'll just touch a button and that's that. And I leave it off. And then I forget a lot of times because they know an hour will turn into six because mom will forget. And I can just turn it off and I can see where they are. Another app that I highly recommend for managing and keeping up with your kids, and they're not paying me to say this, I just tested a lot of things. My kids broke through a lot of things. Green Light. It's called Green Light. It is an app that costs $5 a month, and you can manage your kids' allowance with it. So Green Light is kind of like Venmo. It connects to my bank account, and I have five little pictures there because I got five kids on the Green Light app right now, and my grown kids don't use it. But I have five little pictures, and I can give them money through the Green Light app. I can also assign through the app. So I don't have to have a conversation. I don't have to post anything on the refrigerator. I can give them chores to do weekly or one time and give them a price for it. And when they do it, I just go to the app and check the box and they get the money, or they get it on a weekly basis, or they can ask me for money and I can give it to them or not. But we do a lot of negotiating about, you know, things they want. There's also a way they can save money, so you can help them set goals to save up for things. And because I'm not the kind that makes charts. Like if I had to draw a grid and put sticker stars on it, my head would explode and it wouldn't last. It wouldn't last for very long because I wouldn't keep up with it. But with the Green Light app, it's very much interactive. And you know, it's teaching them how to function in the world we live in. And they can check their Green Light app on their phones. And they can see how much money they have. They can see what they can do to earn more money if they want to earn more money. And the nice thing is, like, if they're at the store
they can use their cards that go, there's like a debit card that goes with it. They can use their card to buy things on their own. So it teaches them a great deal of responsibility, and it teaches them to use their phones and their screen time more like a tool, more as a tool of their lives. And it's less of an addictive behavior that we're having arguments with about all the time. It just becomes more of a tool. And I have found that it's called green light. I really, really like it. It has really helped the relationship with my children, giving them goals, giving them chores, teaching them financial responsibility. And as mom, aka queen of the house, I have control of exactly what they get and when they get it. And I know where they spend all their money and what they're doing. So those are some things just to sort of move the conversation about screen time in a positive direction. They're teach them to use those things as tools. And this sometimes the tool is that they just need to check out and chill and gorge on a game for a while. I'll be playing solitaire, but they may be playing something else that is engaging their mind. I don't see it as a bad thing. As long as you remember to have conversations with your kids, take them to mass, and just keep getting to know them. I'm Stacy Trusankos in for Timory. It's such a pleasure to spend this time with you, and I'm so glad that you tuned in. I hope to see you back on Thursday when we'll be talking about marriage.